Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Friends with Money podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Johnson, a journalist here at Money Magazine. Today, we're talking about one of the biggest financial milestones most Australians will ever face, retirement. A lot of people in their 50s and 60s have a rough idea of when they'd like to retire, but they're often less clear on what actually needs to happen to get them there. So in this episode, we're going to walk through the lead up to retirement from about 5 years out right through to D-Day, or maybe I should say our day, retirement day. Joining me today to talk through what really matters is Nick Bruning, a financial advisor at NetPlan. Nick, it's great to have you.
Brian, pleasure to be with you. And a lot of interesting things to talk about.
It's great to have you, Nick. And Nick, just imagine I've walked into your office. I've picked a retirement date in 2031, and in my head at least, that's locked in. I'm about 5 years out. What are the big things you want me thinking about at this point?
Well, we're firstly going to find out about your family arrangements, whether it's just yourself or you've got a partner. And in some instances, people will still have kids at home. So understanding what the family setup is and whether or not people are likely to be coming and going. But then obviously, we're going to be starting to look at some of the financial aspects, which include your total assets. Now, even at 5 years out, we're already getting a bit of a picture about whether or not you're likely to be entitled to a full or a part pension. Believe it or not, a couple can have more than $1,085,000 in assets over and above the family home and still qualify for a part pension under the Centrelink system. So those sorts of numbers are in the back of my head. We'll probably talk about cash flow and what you're likely to need. Interestingly enough, Ryan, when we get people to do a reasonably detailed budget of where they spend their money, what we find is that in the lead up to retirement and through into the first years of retirement, lifestyle doesn't tend to change that much. So if you're someone that goes out for a round of golf with the fellas on a Wednesday afternoon or coffee with the girls on a Thursday, you'll still do that in retirement. So, it's quite interesting to me that money cash flow out doesn't seem to change too much between when you're working in retirement. So then we're going to be looking at the wish list, the sort of things that you want to do over the next few years. Now, some of that might still occur in the next five in the lead up to retirement, but often beyond it. So the big trip, all that kind of stuff. Then we're going to start looking at the nitty gritty things. And we're talking particularly about debts. I'm one of those people that believes there's no reasonable excuse to have debts in retirement. So we'll absolutely start looking at how we can reduce those debts as quickly as possible over the next 5 years. Bearing in mind that unless it's tax-deductible debt through negative gearing and stuff, it's pretty much going to be dead money that you're paying to the bank manager. So getting rid of the mortgage, getting rid of the credit cards, personal loans, all those sorts of things is what we'd like to do over the next 5 years or so. And yeah, so that's kind of getting the picture where we are 5 years out. It's really about the macro look down on things rather than too much nitty-gritty, because things can change so much over that five-year period.
And speaking about like the money in, money out type of thing, I want to pause on one specific cost, which is insurance. So I'm only 30 and life insurance feels like a non-negotiable in my budget at this point, especially as my partner and I think about starting a family. It just seems like an essential. But if I was 60 and a few years out from retirement, does that change the way I should think about life insurance?
Oh, absolutely. And as you'll probably know, if you're in your 30s, life insurance at that age is relatively cheap. You know, $1 million of cover taken out through your super fund is just a few hundred bucks per year. But the idea of life insurance is to provide an instant cash estate if something happens to you. And at that age, you've probably got responsibilities, a partner, mortgages, perhaps even kids. And you need to be able to provide enough capital there if something happened to you to fund them until they get to adulthood or to sort of see them through until retirement. But as you age, then hopefully you're building up assets around you. So whether that's paying off the house or building up your superannuation, and the circumstances change. So you'll get to a point in life where the kids have left home and you don't have that financial responsibility to raise them anymore. So the idea is that you'll be looking at your life insurance quite, frequently along that path, and reducing it as you go. Because what happens is that $1 million of cover, which might cost you $300 or $400 at 30 years of age, and by the time you get to 60, it's going to be costing you thousands of dollars a year. And that's, again, dead money. If you've got sufficient assets behind you to look after your loved ones, if something dreadful happens, then, then that you let that take over rather than the instant cash amount. I've seen people in their 60s, well into their 60s, still paying the life insurance premiums, and they've got, you know, a couple of houses and a pile in super, and you're sort of scratching your head, why are you doing it? So, yeah, absolutely be looking at it. And, you know, particularly at 5 years out, you're probably at a point where you need very little life insurance, or in many cases, none at all.
Yeah, makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about superannuation. So at my stage of life, I guess I'm putting it into high growth and letting time do what it does best and compound that amount. So 5 years out from retirement, what should my super actually be doing for me at that point? Am I still chasing growth at that stage?
Well, yeah, again, it depends on where you are. And you get some people that, for whatever reason, don't have any super and they need to sort of bolster it up a little bit. But the reality is that for most of us, we've had superannuation now for most of our working lives. And as you've done quite rightly, is in the early years when you're starting out, then you can absolutely look at those high growth opportunities. Now, the downside of that, of course, is that you're going to be subject to the market volatility that happens. And we've just had this sort of recent turmoil, which has seen the market drop by, you know, 10% or so. But in the scheme of things, over 40 years, that's just going to be a blip. So you ride those things through. But as you get into those sort of the late 50s, 60s, when retirement, rather than being a pinprick on the horizon, is actually a big light, it's time to start winding back on that risk as best you can. And look, it's not about trying to pick the markets, but I kind of take the approach that says, well, look, if you've done really, really well and everyone's saying how well the market's doing and, you know, the sort of general consensus that shares are pretty expensive at the moment, then that's actually the time to start backing off a little bit. And there's nothing wrong with taking a slice of your super and putting in something more safe, shall we say, and that would be something like the capital stable or the conservative option. Because, you know, no one super fund's the same. So typically, though, a high growth fund is going to have around about 90% of your money invested in those high growth assets, which is typically going to be predominantly shares, both Australian and international. Of course, as we know, share markets can be quite volatile. When you move into a conservative mix, then what you're looking at is something like about 30% is still going to be invested in those growth assets, but about 70% of your money is going to be invested in the safer kind of things. We're talking about government bonds and corporate bonds. And these are, if you like, loans from the public that the government takes out. And so they're, you know, effectively backed by the government. And so the bonds are in the Australian market and in the international market. So that's sort of a mix. Things are relatively safe compared to a high growth investment. The way I look at it, Ryan, is that if you came to me and said you had $50 million, you've just had a windfall of $50 million, and you wanted to invest it to generate an income of, say, you know, $70,000 a year, Nick, what's your best advice? Stick it in the bank. You don't need any risk if you're generating those sorts of returns, right? But very few of us are in that position. So we're always going to have some growth component as part of our retirement, because even when you retire, there's a good chance you'll be around for another 20 or 30 years. So we still need to have some growth in there. But as I say, I'd like to see people with a fairly conservative capital stable mix by the time they actually get to retirement. And the time to do it is over that next 5 year period where you start to take those profits when they're there, and then sort of let it ride. And then hopefully by the time you get to our day, as we've called it, you know, you're in that safe mix all over.
Well, I hope one day I can come to you with that problem, Nick. That sounds like
the $50 million one.
Problem to have. Yeah, we talked about windfalls in one of our last episodes. So now I'm just dreaming about that moment.
It's coming. It's going to happen, Ryan.
One day. Some long lost uncle somewhere.
Yeah.
But let's fast forward. Like it's no longer 5 years out, but it's 1 year out from retirement. Now, Nick, is it important at that point to actually lock in a retirement date? And what changes when that date becomes real rather than hypothetical?
Yeah. So, look, I have to say that retirement these days is quite a fluid concept, Ryan. I mean, we'll probably perhaps touch on that in a minute. But, you know, a lot of people sort of move through this transitional arrangement where they drop down to a couple of days per week rather than a cold, hard date. But nonetheless, you do want to get a bit of an idea of when you're going to pull the pin. Part of it's to do with the tax aspects, with particularly if you're sort of getting close to the end of a financial year. For example, if part of your retirement strategy is to unwind some of those, you know, negative gearing things with properties and stuff that you might have had set up along the way to save tax, it's often a good idea to time those to be sold in the year where you're no longer working. And that's simply because your taxable income falls dramatically. And you'll end up having that capital gain in a year where you don't have too much other income. So a bit of a timing idea is good at that. There's also considerations about accrued leave, long service leave, holiday pay, all that kind of stuff. In many instances, people have or continue to receive their compulsory superannuation, which is, you know, not insignificant at 12%. So if you've got things like long service leave and that sort of thing, generally we'd advise you actually, you know, work that out rather than get a lump sum. And then you sort of, you know, drop the bundle in the week before you usually go back to work to say, I'm not coming back, I'm going to retire. So a couple of those considerations, and that's why having a reasonable idea of what date you're going to go is it. And, you know, the other thing now that's good, and we might talk about it in a minute, is about the social security system as far as Centrelink's concerned. You can actually stop work now and receive a part pension while you're continuing to perhaps help during a bit of a handover period. That's because you get a free kick of about $4,000, where you can earn $4,000 when you've got a pension, when you've just retired, and that $4,000 won't affect your pension in any way. So it's not subject to the income test. So there's little things like that to know about, which a good financial planner will help you with, and then that will help crystallize an effective date. But as I say, it's unusual these days. You see a lot of people moving into retirement where they're still working and claiming a part pension along the way because they don't realise to claim a pension doesn't mean you have to stop work. It's all about income and assets.
Do you think people who, I suppose, have less in their super should be trying to catch up before that date? And how early should they really start to be looking at extra contributions towards their super, or if that is something that you'd recommend?
Well, look, we thoroughly recommend retiring that non-tax deductible debt as soon as possible. Now, one of the side benefits of that is, of course, you've got freed up cash flow. So the money that was going on the mortgage, going on the car payment, is now free for you to pump into superannuation. And it's absolutely, you know, a great strategy to follow. It's a very tax effective means using salary sacrifice, or which is where you redirect some of your salary into super, or even making your personal contributions to super and claiming them as a deduction at the end of the year. Again, for people with modest amounts in super, we've got this fantastic carryover rule that says that that if you've got unused concessional contributions, and this is the tax deductible amount from the previous 5 years, you can actually use them if your super balance is less than $500,000. Look, it sounds very confusing, but the bottom line is that someone that's got no concessional contributions over the last 5 years and has got a super balance of less than $500,000 can literally pay in one payment, get this, Ryan, of $175,000 and claim it as a tax deduction. So, you know, there's a lot of flexibility within the superannuation system to pump it up, particularly if you've got that spare cash flow. And, you know, and I should make the point too, Ryan, that this isn't about getting rich quick. It's about making sure you've got enough to meet your retirement income needs. And the reason I say that is it's critical to understand how the Social Security or the Centrelink system operates, because what we find is people get spooked into thinking they haven't got enough. They end up getting investing in sort of crazy high risk things in the hope that they'll get to that magic $1 million target and end up losing, you know, some or all of it because it was a dodgy investment to start off with. So if you're in a position where you've got millions of dollars tucked away, fantastic. That's exactly, you know, where everyone would like to be. And it gives you choice. It gives you choice, Ryan, to retire early. It gives you choice to fly up the sharp end of the plane and change your car over every 5 years. But for those that don't have the few million bucks, understand that, you know, it's amazing how well you can do with a reasonably modest amount. You know, I would say to our listeners that somewhere of sort of 300 grand or more would probably be the minimum target level, if you like. But above that, then you've got the social security system working hand in glove with your savings to generate a pretty reasonable retirement. And as I like to point out to people, someone with just 450 grand in super and savings in retirement can generate an income of more than $68,000 a year, tax-free, indexed for life, when we're talking about a home-owning couple, you know, with just 450 grand in super. So you don't need the $1 million. I call it the $1 million myth. Nice to have it if you've got it, but not necessary.
That's a good tagline for this podcast. That's a good way to put it. I suppose an asset a lot of people have at that time is property. So they probably have the family home, but the kids have flown the nest and you've got 4 or 5 bedrooms. A lot of them, it's just like that spare bedroom where you chuck everything in. At least that's the same with my parents.
All your stuff that you're going to take when you come home.
Oh, exactly right. Absolutely. Yeah. It's all stuffed away somewhere. should people be considering downsizer contributions? I know that's a big thing that my parents are considering at this point.
Oh, look, it's a great way of dumping money into super, and it's available to anyone that's over 55 years of age now. Interesting. So what we're talking about is when you sell the family home that you've been in for 10 years and within 90 days of settlement, each person can put in up to $300,000 of super as what we call a super downsizer contribution. So a couple, both in the same home, could potentially put in $600,000 between the two of them. Yeah, it's a very effective way. The other good thing about it is it's not subject to the normal contribution caps, which we won't bore people with, but there's two limits to the amount of money you can put into super, a concessional and a non-concessional. These super downsizers don't count towards either of those, so you can put those in over and above those other contributions to super. Just one thing on the concept, Ryan. I guess a lot of people like the idea that they're going to sell their family home and downsize and release some money that they're going to use for super. That's absolutely a strategy, and sometimes people can downsize into something with they don't need the 4x3 house anymore. But consider this scenario where you've got someone that's in that position where they're going to sell their family home. They've got $1.5 million in super. Interestingly enough, you could take some of that money out of super, take the money which is the proceeds from your house sale, and get a higher value home, perhaps smaller. Downsized does not equal necessarily down value. Get a smaller home that's higher in value, perhaps overlooking the river or something like that. What you've done is you've moved money from an area where Centrelink would assess it to where they don't assess it, which is your family home. And we've had situations where couples have done exactly that, taken some money out of super, added it to the proceeds of the family home, got a much nicer home. It's still an asset for the kids, but they're now qualifying for a part pension and also the valuable pension concession card. So that's another twist, if you like, to the super downsizer, but certainly super downsizer is a very effective way of getting quite a decent amount of money into your super fund.
Yeah, that's a good point. I never thought about it that way before. I might have to check that one out for my parents. At this point in time, there's often a bigger overlooked question around this time of retirement or pre-retirement. Do I actually want to be fully retired? Imagine you're freeing up 40 hours a week, basically overnight, and wonder to yourself, how are you going to fill that time? Do you often see clients rethink what retirement looks like once they've really considered that question?
Absolutely, Ryan. And it's a huge issue and one that certainly the psychologists are looking at as well. But for someone that's in their 30s, you might not get this, but you actually have to have a reason to get up in the morning. And for many people that go into retirement, and I've seen scenarios where people have done a dead, cold, hard stop retirement and basically had nothing to do. And sadly, the reality is that often they don't have a particularly long retirement now because they kind of get bored and, well, I won't say die of boredom, but it's almost like that. So it's really important to have that sort of plan set up about not only what retirement looks like financially, but what you're actually going to do in retirement. So things like, the hobbies and stuff that you might take up. But for many people, it's now working through retirement and past the so-called retirement age. And as I was saying before, it might be down to, starting off going down to 4 days per week, down to 3 days per week, and ultimately 1 or 2 days per week, just to keep your hand in and sort of, have that chat around the water fountain every morning about what you saw on TV last night, all of those kinds of things. But nonetheless, there are people that will continue to work. And as I mentioned before, when they discover that they can receive a part pension, then that sort of changes their mind on a whole lot of things. Because once they get the pension, they get that valuable concession card, which according to the Association of Independent Retirees, could be worth as much as $6,000 or $7,000 a year in discounts and savings. And we're talking about state government concessions on water and local government rates, all that side of stuff, plus the medical stuff. And, it's worth understanding what those thresholds are for you not to get a pension. Generally speaking, it's the asset test that knocks most people out. But if you're a single person that owns your own home and the home can be worth, $3 or $4 million, that doesn't count. Not 1 cent of that $3 or $4 million counts towards the pension asset test. You can have assets of $722,000, which includes your super and bits and pieces, and still qualify for a part pension. Nothing to do with the hours that you work. A couple can have a combined $1,085,000 over and above the family home, no matter what it's worth, and receive a part pension from Centrelink, again, no matter what hours you work. There is another test called the income test. but a single person that's working can be earning close to $76,000 a year, Ryan, and still qualify for a part pension, and a couple, a combined $119,000 a year in earnings from employment and other sources, and still receive a part pension. The other point I'd make, and this is people don't realise this, is that money that you take out of super once you hit 60 years of age is completely free of tax, zero tax. You don't even put it on your tax return. So people can certainly set up an arrangement where they've got an account-based pension, perhaps paying them a bit of an income in retirement, and supplement that, if you like, with a part pension. And if they've still got a bit of employment income coming from work, well, that's part of the mix too. So I guess it's as a planner, you tend to be pragmatic about what people want to do in retirement, and if that includes work, then you know you try and optimize the things to maximize the return from the system. Because after all, we've paid taxes all of our life, and it's about time we started getting something back for it. Well, that's my view anyway. That's why I've got no hesitation in exploring that Social Security option for my retirees.
Yeah, exactly right. We should be getting our tax money back. I feel like we pay enough at it. At least I do. I feel that's entirely fair. So when should I actually be applying for the age pension and the concession cards and all of those types of things? Is it months out, weeks out? Does the process take a long time?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things that you want to do. And look, legally, you can't apply unless it's within 13 weeks of retirement. Okay. So there's no point in going near Centrelink, you know, 6 months out, because they just simply won't accept your application. Look, the easiest way to do it is online via the my.gov.au portal. And you can set up a link to Centrelink. And once you've got that link set up, you can do pretty much everything you need to do, including applying for your age pension online via Centrelink. Good financial planners will do that for you. That's part of providing a full service to people. And it amazes me how many financial advisors out there sort of say, oh, no, you look after the Centrelink stuff. I think a good retirement planner should be taking over all of those, or not taking over, but supervising and helping with all those things, including claiming Centrelink pensions and stuff like that. So yeah, you do it 13 weeks out. You'll need to have all of your sort of ducks lined up, particularly scans or printouts of documents, screenshots, all those sorts of things. All of those will need to be uploaded. And if they're all there, then on the day that you hit retirement, basically your entitlement to a pension kicks in. And you can these days nominate the day you get paid, but for a lot of people it's on a Thursday. Every second Thursday the pension payment comes through. The concession cards are automatically issued. So we've got the MOV pension concession card, which is the one that's probably the most valuable. In most states, you get various discounts on local government charges and bits and pieces like that. If you've got too much in assets, and if you've got too much income, or if you've got too much in income, there's another concession card called Commonwealth Seniors Health Card. Now, it's a complicated way of calculating income, but it basically only has an income test. They don't care about your assets. But a single can have Centrelink accessible income of up to $101,000 and qualify for that card. And for a couple, the threshold is about $162,000. Now, that's combined. So it could be that one person's generating all or most of the income. So yeah, less than 101, less than 161 if you're a couple, you qualify for the Commonwealth Seniors Health Card. That gets you your pills for $7.70 a script. That's your PBS listed drugs, $7.70 a script. Depending on which state you live in, it can be combined with a state seniors card to get you other discounts and concessions. But again, both of those are issued by Centrelink, and both of those, the easiest way is to lodge an application through MyGov, and you need to do it within 13 weeks of your eligibility.
And on the day itself, like our day, as we call it, does anything officially happen? What, if anything, signals that you've reached that day, that you've genuinely retired?
Well, you hear the sound of popping champagne corks, Ryan. That's what happens. Look, it varies for different people. But if you've gone through the process with Centrelink and notified them of the retirement date, then they'll be aware of it. Similarly, your employer obviously knows about it. One thing to check, though, Ryan, when you were talking to the boss about your retirement date, is just to make sure that the last superannuation contribution has been paid in. Now, it's going to change on the 1st of July when we get this thing called Payday Super, which requires the boss to pay your super on the same day as you get paid your salary. But at the moment, the last super payment can go in, this is incredible, 28 days after the quarter in which the liability occurred. So, you know, if you were retiring, for example, in April, the final super payment doesn't need to be made at the moment until late July, which is, you know, that could sort of mess things up a little bit. So what you might want to do is check with the boss to make sure when the final super payment is paid in. That would also mean that when you do access your super, if you do it on the day that you hit retirement, then you need to leave a little bit in there so that the last lagging contribution can hit the fund and then you can pull out a little bit later on. But there's nothing to stop you rolling over the large portion of your super into perhaps an account-based pension fund. There's no one that you need to tell unless you were going to notify Centrelink. But what you can do is now legally sign the form that says I've permanently retired from the workforce and I've turned 60 years of age. And you can sign that form with a clear conscience because you've retired.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Like, I can't wait to that day myself. a fair way away for me, but for a lot of
I'm going to tip for you, Ryan. You buy the champagne now, then it will truly be a vintage by the time you get there.
You're not wrong. That'll be a decent investment. Well, that's the episode for today. If, retirement is on the horizon for you, take your time, get good advice, and make decisions that future you will thank you for. Nick, thank you so much for joining us. That was fantastic. Such great advice in there.
Thank you, Ryan. A pleasure.
And thanks for our listeners. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent, and easy to understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.